This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. As more public figures are accused of sexual harassment and other inappropriate behavior, some have denied the allegations, others have acknowledged wrongdoing, and offered some sort of apology. Keith Herrod is a professor of communication at Western Michigan University. Part of his research has focused on public apologies. Herrod is also the author of the 2006 book Crisis Management by Apology, Corporate Response to Allegations of Wrongdoing. Keith Herrod, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gordon.
It has been a while since we have talked to you on this particular subject. So let's go back and reintroduce you to our audience or introduce you to people who have not heard you interviewed on this topic before. What got you interested in the idea of apologizing from an institutional standpoint?
It goes back a while in the sense of, like most people, you pay attention to news and media accounts. I can still remember it was 1989, and the Chrysler Corporation was accused of unhooking odometers in new cars, driving them around for 50 to 150 miles, and then rehooking them and selling them as new. And Lee Iacocca, who many of our listeners will recognize from the past, very avuncular, talkative, articulate chief executive of Chrysler, went on the offensive after they got caught and basically said, yeah, we screwed up. It was a test program that had some problems. If there was something that was really bad, we'll fix it. And it's a mistake we'll never do again, period. So, you know, that was one of those things where, well, that was interesting. And I don't know what he did and how he did it, but it really seemed to work because it solved the crisis. And, you know, within a couple of days, people were lauding him as a crisis manager. And so it was one of those instances in which you say, you know, that's an interesting phenomenon, and I'd like to know a little bit more about it. And so, you know, that led to the last 30 years of research now.
So as you have studied this, do you have any general conclusions about what makes an effective apology?
Overall, I would say, you know, there are some consistent things with regards to mediated apologies. Certainly, the best apologies are private and interpersonal. And when done and done well, they're magical in many ways because it basically says, I offended you. I did something terribly wrong, or maybe not so terribly wrong. But by my eating some humble pie, confessing what I did was wrong and violated the standards that governed our relationship, we're going to act as if it never happened again. You know, again, that I think is a really fascinating, exciting exchange. Conversely, with corporate apologies, and I use the term corporate apologies, not just for companies and institutions, but also individuals, because if you think of, you know, most media figures, they have publicists, political figures have entire staffs. And so there is a group effort in most public apologies that we hear and say. Certainly, you know, there is the idea of an acknowledgement that an offense was created, that there is some sense of acknowledgement of the wrongdoing. There's usually a little bit of differentiation that explains the context a little bit. The social scientific research on that says you have to be careful with differentiation because the more you explain, the more people start to think, ah, he's weaseling out of it. You know, the final step is usually, what are you doing to make things right? Are there steps that are being taken to ensure it never happens again? Is compensation in order in terms of, you know, just the sense of, you know, an acknowledgement that a wrong was created? And then, you know, the final thing that we don't talk about enough in apologies is once you do it, stop talking. Because, you know, the worst situations, and I think when we had the airlines in the last year who got in all kinds of trouble for removing people in their seats, one case, I can't remember if it was American or Delta, but their CEO did a different apology every day that week. And, you know, we really try to encourage companies and organizations and individuals that are in this kind of situation, that are genuinely upset with what happened and really trying to fix it, to wait till the allegations have sort of settled enough that one apology can, you know, in effect end the story. Because, you know, we would argue that most apologies are ineffective and that the best you can hope for is to get the company out of the news and off the front page.
So other than perhaps continuing to talk when it might be wise to remain silent, and as you said, maybe sometimes trying to sound, maybe say a little too much and sound like you're weaseling out of truly apologizing,
right.
Are there some other ways in which the apology misses the mark? Because as you say, the batting average here is not real good.
I think most people, most institutions, when they are confronted with a situation in which they have to apologize, they don't realize that every day what audience expectations, what consumer expectations, what moral expectations of constituting an effective apology changes. One of my colleagues described it as you're not just shooting at a moving target, but you're in a moving car shooting at a moving target. And so, you know, I think with allegations and acknowledgments of wrongdoing that have come to the news in the last, you know, 2 months with regards to sexual behavior among very powerful men, you know, most of them have in a sense written the traditional apology of, oops, I'm really sorry I screwed up, and I'm going to go to therapy, and I'll promise not to do it again. And if I've harmed anyone, I really apologize, you know. And I think, you know, many in this kind of situation don't realize that what listeners, what critics, what ethicists are looking for is something that really demonstrates that you get what you did wrong and are seeking forgiveness. But you also understand the unique social, cultural milieu that is happening in the world, in media, today.
I guess I also wonder when we start talking about some of the people accused of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct, you know, as you say, powerful men, you know, some of these apologies start to sound very familiar after a while. They have some of the same words in them. And for this particular instance, this particular type of offense, does it need to really stay away from the cookie cutter approach and try to sound a little more heartfelt, be hopefully a little more heartfelt and address the very particular circumstances and individuals affected?
Yes. You know, I think first off, we can't overlook the fact that two things have to happen with an apology. One, moral reflection. Right? The idea of you considering what you have done and coming to the conclusion that it was, you know, reprehensible, that it was wrong. But, you know, to get at your question, the other half of it is a good public apology, and by good I mean meaningful to all, has to be well performed. You know, when we think of some of the apologies we've seen in the last couple of weeks, I think Al Franken, senator from Minnesota, comes to mind. In that his words, if you read them on paper, are very well done, are well crafted, show that he's wrestled with what's gone on over the last 10 years in his personal public and semi-public life. But when you watch it, it's just the opposite. You say he's holding something back. He's not completely being forthcoming. You know, to me, it's analogous to take our listeners way back, you know, the Nixon-Kennedy debates. People who heard it on radio thought Nixon won, and people who saw it on television thought Kennedy won. And the whole point was Kennedy got the new medium of television in the day in a way that Nixon did not.
Of course, now we have a whole nother new medium, which is social media. Has that changed in some way, perhaps the quickness that people expect from an apology? You don't need to call a press conference now. You can point a camera at yourself and put it up on Facebook. You can compose your now 280 character tweet to acknowledge wrongdoing. So is there maybe an expectation on the part of the public that this needs to be addressed a little bit quicker than, say, back when Lee Iacocca was handling the situation at Chrysler that we started talking about?
Yeah, I certainly think social media has dramatically changed the timing, the pacing, and what we expect from apologies. On the other hand, you know, if you think about this kind of context in which we're talking about, especially as it relates to sexual harassment and sexual assault, you have to ask yourself, though, is Twitter the appropriate context for that? You know, I was a fan back in the day of Larry King. And, you know, I would always argue that Larry King's radio show and what was eventually on CNN was kind of a confessional box, right? Where, you know, Larry wasn't going to judge you, but he would always say, well, what were you thinking? What was going on? And, you know, that disarming approach really caused people to open up. You know, I think in some ways, Twitter, conversely, is too easy, right? When we look at Matt Lauer, when we look at Garrison Keillor, when we look at Harvey Weinstein, when we look at Kevin Spacey, none of these men have opened themselves up for questions, right? The only person I know of any, you know, quote unquote stature that's done so is Al Franken. And as we've talked about already, he, you know, his performance left a little bit to be desired in terms of showing true contrition and certainty with regards to all that happened. And so in many ways, I think, you know, social media has given some of these apologists a free pass. You know, the old 60 Minutes idea of reporters, you know, standing outside and ambush journalism with a mic and saying, you know, respond now, certainly isn't the case. We haven't really seen press conferences. And so, you know, I would think in many ways the challenge with social media is that people are going to get wise to it as it being a kind of an unaccountable way to apologize, because you can just put this statement out there.
Some of the statements which have been issued by various people, Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer, come to mind, have included the possibility that not all of the allegations are true, while acknowledging that they have caused some sort of pain, discomfort, etc. But when you sort of leave in the possibility, well, I don't remember it that way, or I don't believe that all this is true, I suppose maybe a lawyer would tell you should say that. But is it also in some ways undermining the apology when it seems that you're trying to say that, yes, I've done some things, but not necessarily all of it?
Yeah, I think the first guy, quote unquote, who did it, it was a smart move, right? And I only mean that in a purely strategic political sense. I don't mean it in any kind of moral or ethical, right? Because it kind of acknowledges, well, you know, there's a little bit of he said, she said in any kind of these kinds of interpersonal contexts and situations. And it also gives them a way to differentiate a little bit and say, well, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm a rogue. You know, I'm somebody who doesn't quite, you know, meet the standards I learned in Sunday school. But, you know, the really bad stuff I probably didn't do. And so, you know, it's a way that, you know, individuals have attempted to differentiate their behavior to give themselves a free pass. At the same time, I think this is where I was getting at this notion of what people expect changes. And the first one who did it was a unique and kind of smart idea. And then the second one, it was, you know, it was derivative. It was, well, yeah, somebody already said that. The other reason I really don't think it works in any of these situations is that what has been unique about what's happened in the last couple months is that there's been volume, right? I think by far the most fascinating thing from a research standpoint in most all of these situations is that by and large, they weren't one-off events, one-off incidents, but there's multiplicity of individuals who've come forward. And so, you know,
almost every one of these people we're talking about, there's been one perhaps complaint that got it started. And then we hear several more people step forward and say, yes, I had a similar experience.
Yeah. So if you say, you know, if it's a he said, she said kind of a thing, and I hate that term, but just acknowledging it, it's where we're at. And you say, well, my memory is a little bit different. You know, somebody could go, well, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, right? But when it's a second individual and a third individual and a fourth individual, that then kind of collapses on itself. And what was originally, quote unquote, a great idea actually functions to subvert the efficacy of the apology.
So many of these people were talking about work for institutions which have their own image that they want to maintain. Some of them sit on large amounts of money they have to think about. Charlie Rose and CBS, Matt Lauer, NBC. Do these institutions, NPR's had a couple of top executives that they've had to let go. And again, they have a reputation they're trying to protect in the case of NPR as being a place where a lot of women have flourished. Mm-hmm. So do these institutions have to think about their own approach here from maybe a little different standpoint than the individual person who is acknowledging in some cases and in other cases apologizing for what they've done?
Yeah, I think the institutional piece has been one of the more disappointing aspects of this, because almost in all of these situations, there was knowledge beyond the immediate principles of what was going on. That individual, yeah, that's Matt, you know, or Charlie's like that. So, by the way, don't, you know, careful about being alone with, you know, this individual. And I really think, you know, that there's a reckoning going on with regards to the whole issue of sexual harassment in the workplace. But I think the second half of the reckoning hasn't happened in the way we would have expected. And that is, I'm of the opinion that there needs to be a separate institutional reckoning. Most organizations seem to kind of do a hunker down mentality, like, oh, shoot, we're going to dominate the news for about 2 days. We'll issue a strong statement that, we really didn't know.
Fire the person who is at the center of it.
We'll fire the person who's at the center, possibly discipline somebody nearby. You should have reported, let us know, kind of thing. But by and large, the institutions, I think, haven't, stepped up. And really said, yeah, we had a culture that we tolerated that. I think NBC is still vulnerable on that. I know Fox News with Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, had what we would call a rough week. But again, they were able to just sort of manage it without, heavy duty sanction by public. I think the really interesting situation going on right now, and it's been slow moving, has been, the situation with Dr. Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University. You know, when you compare the response with regards to Penn State and what happened there, Michigan State has really been able to avoid answering a lot of questions. And I'm grateful that, the Attorney General sent a letter to Michigan State and in effect said, you have to tell us what you know and when you knew it. You know, in most of these kinds of situations, people do get fired. To date, only the gymnastics coach at Michigan State, was encouraged to move on.
Was allowed to retire.
Yes.
Who apparently had known about Dr. Larry Nassar's transgressions.
Correct.
For quite a while.
But, the athletic director is also somebody that's usually
culpable.
Mark Hollis has a national reputation that I think has protected him. Even the Lansing State Journal, from my understanding, I don't know if it was an editorial from the newspaper per se or a guest editorial.
It was a front page editorial from the newspaper calling for the president, Lou Anna Simon, to step down. But,
yes.
But no mention in there of whether Mark Hollis should keep his job.
Yeah. Well, and, my expectation is if the president goes, others are going, with him or her. But again, it is one of those situations where these activities, these behaviors do not occur in a vacuum, and our institutions need better mechanisms for reporting. We need more positive cultures, that encourage people to come forward so that, we can ensure that, everybody who goes to work is evaluated on doing their job and doing their job well, and doesn't have to deal with, a hostile climate and work environment.
So I'm going to date both of us here. About 20 years ago now, almost 20 years ago, you and I did one of these interviews after Bill Clinton acknowledged having an affair with Monica Lewinsky while he was president. That ultimately led to him being impeached. The Senate voted against removing him from office. But as you and I talked then, President Clinton had issued an apology, which many people criticized for the way it sounded. He, though, came back and took a couple more stabs at it. And of course, as we see, he ultimately was allowed to complete his term in office. I guess my question is, you know, does the first attempt at an apology necessarily, if it doesn't go well, do you get another chance? But is there a limit? Can you run out? Can you reach a point where people finally say, you know what, that was 3 times, that was 4 times, that was 5 times, and still you don't have it right. So obviously you're not sincere, or you really don't want to address the behavior.
Yeah, well, one of the things that is most critical in an apology is that it appear voluntary, that you've come to the conclusion yourself. Now, when you think of all of these cases, President Clinton and the contemporary examples, you could argue none of these apologies were voluntary, you know, because they got caught, and this is what you do, quote unquote, when you get caught. You know, I do think people recognize when moral reflection happens. And if there is moral reflection that is demonstrated in a subsequent apology, I think people will respond, you know, to that favorably and positively. You know, one of the things we say in apologies is that time is structural, not chronological. You can wait too long, and nobody knows what that is. But if you wait too long, you know, then your apology is seen as, you know, you didn't really mean it, you didn't care. But you can also apologize too soon. Because again, then, you know, there was an opportunity for reflection to have occurred. And so
it looks more like you're trying to save your image rather than really think about what you might have done.
Well said. Yeah. And, you know, I think we have examples in the contemporary discourse in which, you know, some were almost immediate, some took a while. You know, I think, again, Senator Frankens was the one that probably most demonstrated this notion of moral reflection occurring. President Clinton, you know, I think that's an interesting case that has really come back, and largely because of what's going on in Alabama with Senate candidate Roy Moore, with the idea of, well, President Clinton got away with it. And, you know, if you think about it, he didn't, because, you know, he had the public humiliation of, you know, having to, you know, testify before a grand jury. But also, you know, the public apologies, and he was ultimately impeached by the House. And so, you know, I think there is a sense that that was a case in which there was a process well executed by all. Not really, but nonetheless, in which, you know, I think there was an attempt, you know, to hold him accountable. And I think, you know, that's what we would like in all of these contexts in which, you know, there's been allegations and evidence of wrongdoing, and that is that individuals be held accountable.
So as you mentioned, most of these public apologies seem to miss the mark. Very few of them would you say, oh, okay, they did it right. And I find that interesting because, you know, lots of institutions go through some sort of crisis management, you know, or have some sort of crises come up that they, you know, have to deal with. And I'm just kind of maybe surprised that there isn't more of a professionalization out there of people who look at how to get through a difficult time and say, here is the right way to address it. Here's the right way to apologize. This will not completely mitigate the problem, but it's the best way to get through it. And is it your sense that maybe, you know, not enough institutions have really considered what it means to acknowledge difficulties and truly apologize for something that's gone wrong?
Again, I think this kind of thing ultimately comes back to the nature of the offense. When we look at institutional apologies, you know, when you think of some of the horrific things that have happened over time, you know, the Holocaust, for example, Union Carbide, and the hundreds of individuals in Bhopal, India, who were gassed, you know, to death because of a chemical leak. how can you apologize, you know, in that situation? To whom would you apologize? You know, the victims are gone, and many times their families are gone. Time has passed. And so you really run into some difficult questions when you look at institutional apologies. I think most of the institutional apologies we see nowadays are largely, you know, what we would call media flap. There's, you know, been a poor customer service. Somebody was treated badly. A company did something that wasn't quite in line with their stated or public values, and so they get some grief. But conversely, you know, look at you know, the oil spill by BP in the Gulf after the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon. You know, you can apologize the first week because, you know, you would, okay, well, we now recognize the gravity of it, but that oil poured out for close to 6 months. So, you know, you can apologize, but it's still happening. And so, you know, do you do one a week? Do you do one when it starts, one in the middle, and one when it ends? And so you can see where it really is difficult to get right relative to, you know, shareholder, stakeholder, audience, media, and ethical expectations, because everyone's just a little bit different. One that we talk about a lot in our crisis literature, there was right after the Exxon Valdez ran aground in Prince William Sound, Alaska, there was an oil spill off the coast of California about 6 months later. It was the American Trader by BP. It was a BP-owned ship called British Petroleum back then. And they nailed their crisis response, in which, you know, the substance of it was, our lawyers tell us it wasn't our fault, but it sure feels like it, and we're going to do everything we can to fix it, okay? You know, that was a great response in 1990. Kind of thing. But of course, as we've talked about a number of times, what people expect and where the bar is and where the line is has, you know, changed and changed repeatedly.
Keith Herrod, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Keith Herrod is a professor of communication at Western Michigan University and has studied how apologies are used in crisis management. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.